The numbers show that most of the startups that are founded will get stuck at any point. They will get stuck and don't know what to do, have to figure out, do we continue? How do we transform the company? How do we get unstuck? Today's guest is Dave Hirsch, and Dave co-founded Jive back in the 2000s and bootstrapped it to more than 10 million in ARR, then brought on an investor, went public. And after he left the company, he saw pretty much every side and every angle of entrepreneurship. He coached founders. He became an investor on the private equity side. He became a board partner for Andreessen Horowitz. He bought and sold companies. He bought stuck companies, helped them get unstuck, and then sell them afterwards. And he recently wrote a book called Reignition, where he describes his process for founders to understand where my company stands, how do I as a founder probably block the company from succeeding, and what are the reasons and why we are stuck, or why I feel that the company is stuck, and how do I get it unstuck. So today's episode will focus on, is the venture ecosystem broken? Why is it that way, that it feels like it's broken? And when you have the feeling that your company is currently not where you want it to be because only a few percent are these outperformers with triple, triple, double, 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 and IPO ready in a few years and here and there, then this episode is for you. So this episode might be one where you want to take out paper and a pen and actually write a few notes and figure out what is applicable to your company and venture and what isn't. So without further ado, welcome Dave Hirsch.
Thanks so much for having me.
The first question I'd love to jump into is, because when I read the book and especially the introduction, I realized that you're not a 100% a fan of the venture ecosystem only. I mean, you're a bootstrap entrepreneur yourself for a while, then you took funding, you IPO'd a company, or the company you built IPO'd, and you bought and transformed several companies since then, have seen all the sides of the ecosystem as well. To what degree do you think the venture system and ecosystem is broken?
It's a great question. And, you know, I wouldn't say I'm not a fan. I actually believe in the power of venture capital, but I think it's gotten too big. When I came out of college 30 years ago, it was along the lines of $8 billion a year in the US invested. And now it's in the $300 billion. And I think what it's done is create a system that people feel like they need to adhere to. And that drives the way that they think about their businesses. In other words, they will say, we raise our seed, then 18 months later, we'll raise an A, then we'll raise our B, and then a C. And it's kind of like the tail wagging the dog a little bit, where this is not the ideal way to rate, you know, to build a business. The business should be built based on what the market potential is and what its unique strategy is. And it should finance based on the opportunity, not on a set timeline. And so I think it's become kind of lazy shorthand for investors and business builders sometimes, and it gets them into trouble because they'll raise earlier than they should, they'll raise more than they should, and that's what leads to getting stuck. And as the guy that helps startups get unstuck, I see the other end of it, which is companies that have raised too much and they've set too high a bar for what they can actually achieve. And so I think entrepreneurs need to understand that venture capital is a hits business, meaning they make their money on one out of 10 companies, roughly. But the entrepreneurs believe they have an 82% chance of success, right? And I'm all about optimism. But sometimes I think it's blind optimism that can lead to raising too much money too early, scaling too quickly and too aggressively before the company's ready. And that's what leads to getting stuck.
I think before we dive deeper into all the parts that you mentioned, the first question that I have in mind is, what do I have to assess when I'm starting a company? What are the questions that I have to ask myself, and also could be a solo founder or a founding team? What do we have to answer before we decide if we bootstrap, if we raise venture? to figure out what kind of company we want to or even should build?
Yeah, I think you answered your own question in a way, right? Is that's the question. What do we really want to build? You know, what's in our heart? What do we want to do? And it's a bit of an existential question for people. Why am I on this planet? What am I here to do? And, you know, what is going to bring me the most joy? What is my superpower? What does the world need? How do I bring these things together in a way that reflects the journey that I want to be on? And I think a lot of times entrepreneurs see the business as a means of validating themselves and wanting to, you know, meet certain expectations of their peers or other people in their life. And so raising money looks from the outside like it's success. But what it does is, again, create a high bar that may be hard to live up to. And so for a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, I'm not saying bootstrapping is necessarily best versus raising venture. It might be something in between. But I do think there is, you know, a path where if you can go longer and leaner, meaning maybe raise some seed capital, but stretch it out and enough so that you can start to feel the pull of the market. And this is the big, big differentiator for successful companies in my mind, is that companies that raise too much too quickly do it on a false story in a lot of ways, or they take a few data points and use that as the basis for a trend. In reality, you're just not there yet. And what they end up doing is pushing a product to market. So they're trying to scale the business too quickly and they're building a product and they want to, you know, get it out to market. They want to launch it. And when you're pushing a product onto the market that really doesn't want it, you're wasting a lot of time and energy potentially. Versus if you're iterating and experimenting and testing hypotheses, eventually what happens is you start feeling the pull of the market. So if you can be thoughtful and extend that seed capital and extend that first phase of the business to the point where you can really start feeling the pull. And the pull means you have people like, I have to live with this thing. You know, you can't take it away from me. This is a huge pain point. We really need this. We'll pay you money tomorrow. It does happen eventually, right? But it takes longer than a lot of entrepreneurs may think. And so in my mind, yeah, it's not so much whether VC, it's how much and when and how long you can stretch it.
Would you say the too much capital and trying to raise too much too early, etc., is this a problem created by founders, created by investors, created by media? Like, where does it start?
Yeah, great question. And I think it's a collective. You know, I look back to my time and it was all of those things. You know, there was a lot of really smart, well-connected VCs who were convincing me to take their money. And, you know, that's an interesting proposition when you have people that smart who are telling you, we like what you're doing, we want to give you money for it. You know, that's exciting. And the press plays up the stories of the big winners, but they don't really talk about the other 90% of companies so much.
Guilty.
Yeah. And it's fun. It's fun to think about the big winners, but also to understand how they got to be there. And usually these big winners started by doing one thing really, really well. Right. You know, Airbnb was doing inflatable mattresses in conferences and Amazon was selling books and Google just had a, you know, better algorithm for search and all these things. They started doing one thing really, really well. And I think a lot of times entrepreneurs want to jump to the conclusion, which is we want to go serve a big market with a whole new product. And they try to, you know, shortcut the process to being a big company as opposed to recognizing that being a big company is the product of doing one thing really well in a small market, fixing something, you know, on a smaller scale, usually, not always, but usually fixing that tiny thing, being the best in the world at one little thing, and then watching that expand organically into other areas.
Would you say that's true for all companies out there? Is also, if I'm trying to build in the deep tech space, if I'm trying to build something like SpaceX or other companies?
No, that's why I'm saying it's not true in every case, right? I mean, there are, you know, climate tech companies that are building up big infrastructure for energy and things like that. It's just a different proposition. So, but what I see when we're talking about the startup ecosystem is 95% of the companies that are getting started are not, you know, big infrastructure companies that need huge amounts of capital just to get up and running in the first place. We're talking about, you know, software companies and consumer tech companies and ones that can actually be lean and disciplined and austere in those early days just to try to get something out to market.
I would even say that some founders sell themselves a bit on the side of, hey, it's so complex what we're building, even when it could be a simpler software solution, a simpler go-to-market strategy for the start, for to validate the product that or the problem that they want to solve. And they're selling themselves a bit on the story of, hey, we need to raise money for that. We need to be one of the PR-heavy early stage companies.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two things in there. One is just aiming towards complexity, when in reality you need to aim towards simplicity, both in the product as well as its positioning, right? I mean, that's super important. You know, the other is just, yeah, how much money you're raising. And when I think entrepreneurs tend to get nervous if they see other people in the space raising. This came up yesterday. I had a call. They were like, you know, in an AI adjacent space. And they're like, well, everybody else is doing it. We got to go raise money. We got to go big. This is the chance. There's a window. And that rarely works in my perspective, right? I think people get into a fear state emotionally where they see other people doing something and feel like I'm going to lose my chance. But the best companies can actually be patient and sit through that and just focus on the customer, focus on doing their one thing really well and letting the market dictate who the big winner is, but not falling prey to a fear state that causes you to make irrational decisions.
I think you mentioned before, or I'm sure I know you mentioned before, the 10% outlier chance for that return venture capital, like not in total, but that return the funds that are actually relevant to like the big successes, while more than 80% of founders think they are one of those 10% companies. So the question is, because I think a lot of founders listening are like, yeah, that's cool, but I am one of those 10% companies that are like going huge, the moonshots, the Stripes, Airbnbs, Ubers of this world. How would you assess if you're on the trajectory to go there versus, hey, probably I shouldn't overreach at the moment? Because it's a constant question. It's a strategy question that I have to ask myself. Like, where on the scale do I position myself to set the guidance for the next years?
Yeah, I guess going back to your earlier question of what do people do when they start a company and what are the questions they should ask themselves? One is, what is my risk tolerance? Am I swinging for the fence on this one, right? Am I willing to go into this with the expectation that there's only a 10% chance of success? And am I okay with that? In which case, have at it. But I don't think going in assuming that you have an 80% chance of success when you're running a traditional venture type of business, because you're going to make decisions that are irrational, right? Because you're not making decisions that reflect what the reality and likelihood of the outcome really is. And so I think when you say this is the risk I am willing to take with this business, and that's in alignment with your co-founders and with your investors, then you can finance the business and run it in a way that reflects that risk tolerance. And I think that's the thing that I like to push people on, is to say, it doesn't have to be just A round, B round, C round, you know, and don't fall prey to, well, my competitor is doing this, and so I need to do it. Or if ultimately you want to build something that has an 80% chance of success, then you have to buy that chance of success with being lean and staying lean longer and maybe serving smaller market needs and getting cash in the business sooner rather than later. It sounds like from talking to you, too, that a lot of German startups actually have, you know, more of that approach to building cash friendly business, which is great. I think here in the U.S., maybe we have this lemming like, you know, we have to be on the VC bandwagon and not really think about the ways in which businesses can be built more creatively, where how you can fund these things, how long you go with certain capital, what metrics really matter most at what phase of the business. And that's what I've seen, is looking back on the companies that failed and then talking to entrepreneurs that are second or third time founders and how they've done it differently. They've learned a lot, and they've learned it the hard way. So if we can shine a light for people who are first or second time founders on exactly what you're asking, right? Which is, what is your risk tolerance? What do you want to do in the world? What is the reason you're here? And let's think about the right way to set the good milestones for the business and how to finance those milestones in a smart way.
I think one of the things that has to happen for that to become more normal, I would say, is understanding and promoting that companies that are not unicorns are not less important or not less relevant or less great than building a unicorn company. Building a sustainable, profitable company that can run, probably you can hand it over to a CEO and let it be managed at some point, or you can stay in yourself and find new opportunities to grow. That's not less, you're not less great of an entrepreneur if you're not the next Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. And some of those companies, by the way, if you go longer without raising and staying leaner and actually get cash flow positive, some of them actually have breakout potential. So in other words, you wait and see what the market says. And in some of those cases, this happened when I was at Jive. We bootstrapped for 5 years. We had a $12 million, very profitable business. And then suddenly we felt the pull of the market in a really strong way. This is when Facebook first came online and businesses were like, we want more of this kind of style of collaboration. And we made a decision. We're feeling a deep, deep pull. And so we raised money and were able to accommodate that pull. But it was 5 years into the trajectory, right? And so all that to say is there may be an opportunity for a breakout. But even if not, if you own more of the business and you're not diluting yourself through rounds and rounds of funding and pushing yourself too hard and burn out too quickly and die as a company, if you give yourself that time and space, you may find that there's a breakout at the end of the day. Or if not, you still do well.
Yeah, fair enough. I think before we dive into finding and assessing, for example, breakout moments, I think we have to take a step back and get back to the point where you said, hey, don't raise money too early, don't raise too much. When would you say is the right time to raise it all? If I decide I want to raise, can be family and friends, can be angel investors. When is the right time? What needs to be done, or what questions need do my team and I have answered for ourselves before we go out for the first smaller fundraise, I would say?
Yeah, I have less of an issue with seed funding, right? Which a lot of times people just need to earn a salary. They need to, you know, have some people on their team just to go out and validate the product idea.
Do we differentiate here between private investors and institutional investors in a seed round?
You can. I would say if the institutional investors are investing under the belief that you are going to raise again in a certain period of time, then that is a distinction I would call out, because that's putting you on a train that may not be the right train for you to get on. Not all institutional investors are that way. Okay. So you want flexibility, right? And that's why I think things like safe notes are actually a good thing, because what it does is say, we're not taking on any equity out of the gate. Therefore, we still have flexibility. We still call the shots. And based on what we believe is the market potential here, we can decide how to fund the business later. So I think, you know, if you believe in the vision or you've got direct experience in this industry and you know that you're solving a pain point, I don't have an issue with seed capital or even A rounds. It's all based on, is there legitimate data to back up the supposition that you're raising that money under? So oftentimes what I see as successful is, yeah, you're doing early stage funding, seed funding, could be from angel investors, individuals, could be a safe note, but try to extend it as long as possible to really understand the market at a deep level and believe in your core that you are solving a pain point that is unique to what you're doing and your solution, and you can solve that pain point beyond a shadow of a doubt. I don't care how small it is. It could be a small market. That's fine. But once you have that belief and a sense of we're onto something, I wouldn't do subsequent funding rounds until, you know, that's really the case. Plus, it's going to be hard anyway. But I think what I see happen a lot of times is companies jump the gun on the A round, you know, and it's very competitive from the venture side as well. So what you get is a lot of venture investors who will want to preempt. They'll want to come in and I want to work with these guys. I want to get this company. I want to get this deal. And so they'll come in earlier so that they can be the one who, you know, gets that investment. And for the entrepreneur, that may feel really good to be wanted, right? And they may want to say, hey, let's just get this closed up. Then we've got the cash. We don't have to worry about it. The issue is it's based on a few data points that aren't justification of a trend. And it's putting them into a situation where they now have a very high bar to live up to for that A round. And they're immediately feeling like they're behind the eight ball. And then it becomes, okay, we need more money. And how do we get, you know, how do we prove that we can get to the B round? And they try to raise a B round on a, you know, a similarly weak story, right? So you want to be in the situation where it's irresponsible not to raise money. So, you know, you're getting such market pull, you can't keep up with it, right? We can't hire customer service people fast enough, right? Like our salespeople are buried in leads right now, and we can't get the customers live fast enough. Those are problems that are, that's good to raise money, right? It's irresponsible not to. Your team's really burnt out and you can't keep up with the demand. If it's, we have to weave a complex narrative, you know, based on a few random data points in order to get this funding and try to push this product out to more people in the market and spend way more on sales and marketing, that's not as good. And I do see that happen pretty frequently. You'd be surprised.
There are a few brackets that you opened that we need to close again. The first is, how much money do I raise? Especially like, let's stick with the seed round. Like, how do I assess how much money I want to do? Because recently when I talk to founders, it's like often as much as I get. And I'm quite sure from what you said that that's not always the right answer.
Yeah. Again, it is circumstantial. But, you know, some of the things like safe notes can be done in such a way where you can, you know, add on to it later if need be to extend it.
By the way, for all Germans, safe notes are the U.S. equivalent to convertible notes in a way. So
sorry.
Yeah. No, just an explanation that if you feel confused, that's, for example, what Y Combinator does with and recommends most of the startups to do and set the standard with. And in Germany, that's a bit more on the convertible notes side and convertible loan that you also have in the US, but somehow similar.
Yeah. So I work with a lot of first-time founders and I work with a lot of third-time founders. Third-time founders will brag about how little money they've raised. First-time founders will brag about how much they've raised. And with the third-time founders, what they will do is for that convertible note or initial funding, it'll be a very small team, 3 or 4 people who are collectively like this founding SWAT team or, you know, tiger team, whatever you call it. I don't know if there's a form in Germany that you use, but that small team of people who are very creative, flexible, smart business builders where they bring the tech and market thinking together in a way to go out and test these hypotheses and run it. And if they have an idea for how long it's going to take to get that market validation, they will probably still raise more funding, another 6 to 12 months than they think, just to be able to go on with that small team for longer. And what the more experienced ones I've found will do is to collect a lot more data points and actually get solutions in place, try to get some money coming in, try to get, you know, into very specific places in the market that nobody else has gotten into and feel a deep sense of conviction that I have found my spot to start this company, and then they will go raise.
I think the second part that you started with, or that I, as a founder, if I'm in the venture mindset, will think about is, yeah, of course, I could drag out the seed round a bit more, like use it longer and stretch it. But I have to hit my first million in AR. I have to triple after that time. I have to triple after that time. And like this feeling of pressure of growth. And I'm not sure if it's already at all cost, but still like trying to hit those milestones and targets as quickly as possible. What are you telling founders that are too worried that they don't hit their sales targets fast enough?
This is the inherent problem of raising the money, is that if you raise money based on the assumption that you're going to go hit sales targets, then your whole raison d'etre as a company becomes about hitting sales goals as opposed to learning. And so companies try to shift into scale it mode when they should still be in figure it out mode. And that's the inherent challenge. That is everything I see in these startups that get stuck. Not everything. I would say 80% of the startups I see that get stuck, it was a situation where they tried to scale prematurely. They tried to get into, let's hire salespeople, let's start cranking this out, and that's going to allow us to go raise more money. So to me, that is the central challenge. And I think there are, maxims like triple, triple, double, 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 go public, things like that, that do way more harm than good. And entrepreneurs believe they have to get on that track. And investors, it's nothing against them, but they don't understand the business well enough. They only have 5% of their time to spend on this particular business, right? And so they're going to use pattern recognition as the basis to provide feedback. That pattern recognition may work at some companies, but it certainly doesn't work at all. And every company is a unique organism unto itself. And so if you start trying to apply traditional maxims that you hear from the market to your company, traditional playbooks, that's where you start getting into trouble, because this business is a sensitive organism and the market is a sensitive organism. And it takes a long time to figure out your place in that market. And if you can go longer on a small amount of money, that's going to offer you the best chance at really understanding where you fit in. And then once you understand where you fit in, you can build out a growth plan and finance the business in a way that's reflective of that real opportunity, not of some belief in what it's going to look like in the future that's based on patterns from VCs and playbooks and what the media says.
It's interesting that you're the guy, you said it yourself, the guy that gets companies unstuck. And we're spending a lot of time to even prevent getting stuck at all. We will come to the later part as well to assess what's happening when I got stuck and how to get out of it. But I think it's so important to think about the right setup of a company that doesn't pressure myself into things where I'm like, holy crap, how do I get my company out of this? So let's say I want to raise venture and I did my seed round. I came to a point where I feel the pull of the market, where it feels irresponsible not to raise. What would you look for in the venture investor? So to give a little detail, you said you raised venture. You raised from a very well-known firm here in SF, in the Valley. I think you saw it all at the same time as you've been a board member for A16Z. So you know a few of the investors here and know what they're good at, not good at, and probably also have thought about it once in a while. What would I have done differently back then when I would have the chance again to pick an investor? What would you say? What to look for? How to assess if the investor I'm talking to is the right for what I'm looking for?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think a lot of it is personal connection. When you sit down with this person, because there's the firm itself and understanding the resources that they have. And does the firm understand the market and business that you're in? And do they have resources that are going to be helpful to you and what you're trying to do? Have they done similar deals? Do they understand the space? That's important. More important, I think, is the partner that you're working with. And do you feel simpatico with them? Meaning, can you build a deep relationship? Do you feel like there's a sense of trust? Can they really understand the business? Do you like the advice they're giving you and the feedback? Do you feel like this is somebody that's going to be really helpful to the growth of the business? And following what we talked about before, is their advice really unique to this business? Meaning, or are they trying to just implement a playbook? Are they saying, you know, what you need to do is triple, triple, double, 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 right? You know, they're trying to push a playbook approach on you, in which case I would say, beware, because playbooks are playbooks for a reason, right? And if everybody's doing the same playbook, it just doesn't work. And so I think the more trust you have, the deeper the relationship, the more they seek to really understand the business and where their advice is unique to the situation of this business, that's going to be a better fit.
One question I had in mind is understanding how well they can understand your business and understand what you're up to. And I thought about former industry experts and built in the same space versus just have a very good understanding of how to assess businesses and then also figure out what to do in a certain way. Do you think it's helpful or harmful if somebody built in the same industry before and has experience that they rely on?
I think generally it's good. It's better if they understand the industry and the trends in that industry, as long as they're not locked into historical patterns or approaches, right? And that's the one thing I'd look out for. So industry experience, good, but if they still see the industry the way that it was 10 years ago, or they're not shifting their approach to how to disrupt that industry and how to fit into it, then that's what I would look out for.
So you probably don't want to hear, it hasn't worked 10 years ago, so don't try it.
Right. Or it worked this way 10 years ago, let's do that again.
Fair enough. The other side is true as well. Let's talk a bit about the maneuvering into a situation where I currently feel like it's not the perfect story that I wished for as a founder. And I think there are so many different indicators that could be uncovered a bit earlier to already see, hey, we're maneuvering in a way that might not end where we wanted to. What would you say founders should look for to understand if they're on the right track versus if they're getting their company or managing their company, building their company into a way where it might get stuck at some point?
Yeah, and it does depend on the stage of the business. But a lot of this comes to the intuition of the founders, right? Do they feel like it's working? And or are there, is the team feel too big? And there's people who don't seem to be doing the right stuff for the company, or they're not in alignment with other people in the business and what they're doing. Are there a lot of confused people? Are you not getting that pull of the market? Are you not getting the response you want? Are you not getting the deals, you know, or sales that you're looking for? So I would say we sometimes tend to be too data driven, but what you're asking, I think, tends to be a lot more intuition driven. And a lot of times the founders have a deeper sense of how it's really going than they may even give themselves credit for. And if they can tap into their intuition and maybe have advisors who can help them think through it and give them feedback and be a sounding board, that really is the best situation. So that they don't feel alone in these decisions or overwhelmed by them or just holding that stress, that they can give voice to it and have a set of people who can help them think through the situation and offer them advice on where to go from there. So that would be the best in my mind.
It's interesting because it's a bit counterintuitive to what I hear from founders and investors, but often on the venture side, because many of them try to build very data-driven and comparable businesses, like trying to benchmark their KPIs to other ventures that grew to the certain stage that they want to grow a few years earlier, and trying to use the data to make data-driven decisions and understand where we're at. And it just sounds counterintuitive somehow.
Yeah, it does. I was in a conference recently, and there was a UGC, a user-generated content session, that was about data versus intuition. And everybody in there was telling stories of, you know, when they did the wrong thing, you know, when they should have used intuition. And most of them were that, which is we were trying to use data when we should have used intuition. And I think we do get, especially with the proliferation of data and how much is available to people. And but there is a compare and despair element to this, right? If you're just trying to benchmark yourself, you're going to get overly stressed. You're going to try to fix the metric sometimes instead of fixing the underlying problem. And developing that intuitive sense of how things are really going is incredibly important. And that has way more repercussions on the positive trajectory of the business than just trying to live up to certain data points and trying to present that to investors or board.
Basic question, but when do I know what to use, data or intuition?
Intuition. I have an intuitive sense. That's where I think advisors can be super helpful. So, you know, people who have been through this before and can be that sounding board for the founders. And I work with a lot of founders who are product founders, and they are brilliant at building product and they're great engineers. But when it comes to other parts of the business, they're trying to engineer it like a product. And sometimes that's not the best thing. If you're building a sales organization, you don't want to over-engineer it or try to too tightly manage it to data points. You know, there's a level of art to it that needs to be accommodated. And so I think, yeah, over time, founders can start to develop that intuitive sense of how things are going, and they can feel it. And you can feel it in the executive staff meetings and one-on-ones and conversations with customers. It's either working or it's not, and you start to know. So I think that's really important. I do think, you know, having a set of mentors who represent different backgrounds and areas of expertise is really, really helpful to the overall journey for founders.
From what you've seen in all the companies you analyzed, worked with, built, bought and rebuilt, what would you say is the flywheel that often leads to being stuck as a company?
The biggest thing is that premature scaling that I spoke about before. And so that comes from raising too much too quickly and earlier in the trajectory than you should, hiring too many people, trying to scale up sales and marketing before you really understand that pull, not hiring the right people. You know, sometimes people hire really well in their department that they come from, the founders do, but then they mishire in other areas. Trying to adhere to playbook advice and just trying to do what the industry says you should do instead of having that deep intuition. But yeah, I would say it's all classified under this heading of we're trying to scale it before we've really figured it out. And that figure it out period just takes longer than people think. And if they can go leaner longer, it's way better for that likelihood of being in the 10% successful companies.
To the hiring part, do I, as a founder, try to become better hiring in the parts that are departments and teams that are not my core? Or do I try to add people that are then better in hiring exactly in those departments?
I think what you're saying, yeah, do we hire people who know how to hire, or do we just hire people who are, yeah, who are great? In the early stages, you obviously have to just hire, you have to use your own intuition. As the company scales and it's successful and you do start selling and really growing the business, and it's, you know, what they call a scale up, I guess, then you do want to find people who are way better than you at those individual departments that you really trust, but that also reflect the skill set that is needed. So I speak to the Stanford MBA students about Jive case study twice a year. And it's about a thing called the sales learning curve. And the sales learning curve is how to sell new products, but in three stages, right? As a product is new and it's first coming to market, what types of sales DNA do you need? Who are the types of people who are going to do really well? And then in this transition stage, as you start to get product market fit, and now you're trying to work towards repeatability, that has a different set of characteristics of people that you're hiring. And then in the more mature execution phase, as things are really taking off, what are the types of salespeople and marketing people and what's your go-to-market look like? And so I find that helpful to think about, you know, there's these three phases of startups or products within those startups, which is you're first getting it out to market and who are the types of people you need. Now it's in market, but you need to find how to do it really well and make it really repeatable. And then, you know, it's off to the races and it's very profitable. And how do you scale it at that point? So within each of those phases, you just have different, you know, sets of characteristics of the team. Your hiring goals are going to be, you know, unique to that phase. So if you kind of understand where you are and see it less as a single entity startup, but more as where are we in the trajectory and who do we need, that'll help figure out who the right types of people to hire are. Because what I see a lot of times is, especially product founders, when it comes to, okay, the board is telling us we need to grow, I need to go hire a salesperson. First of all, salespeople all present really well. They all look really fine. They look really, it's what they do, right? So they all show really well. And so it's easy for a product founder to go, this guy looks really good, you know, or this woman worked at Google and she did this thing. But in reality, a lot of times they're hiring people who are further along in their skill set than where the company is in its trajectory. And that's where they start to get into trouble. And it costs a lot of money to learn those lessons. So I work with a lot of companies that have, you know, hired two or three different sales execs that didn't work out, often because they just didn't know how to hire the right person for where they were.
So when my intuition as a founder says, my company is stuck, how do I start to assess the situation? What are the things that I need to understand and get my head around to even have the opportunity to get it unstuck again?
So stuck can mean a lot of things, but it's really in the eye of the beholder, meaning if I feel like this company is not going where I want it to go, where the investors want it to go, if I feel like I'm stuck in an eddy, you know, and I'm not flowing down the river that I'm supposed to be going down, something's wrong. What do I do? And in some of these cases, you know, I work with companies that are stuck, but they may have a $5 or $10 million, $20 million business that is their core, but they try to grow too quickly. And now what I'll try to do is help them get back to their core to say, what is your best in the world superpower? And how do we strip out everything else and just do that really well? And ideally build out a really profitable, healthy business around that core. And then once that's running smoothly, then we can start experimenting with real growth that extends from that core. And that's when you finance the business based in a way that reflects what the real market need is. It may not be venture capital. It may be debt. It may be no investment. You're just doing it organically. Maybe it's private equity or, you know, there's other forms of funding. It's got to reflect what the real opportunity is with that business at that point. In some cases, you're talking about companies that are truly pivoting. And I had a call this morning with a company like that, and they have really good technology, but their industry got pummeled and they have to like come back and say, all right, well, what do we do? We're the best in the world at this particular technology set or this particular industry problem. We know it really well, but it's no longer viable to do it in the way that we've been trying to do it. And so we have to come back and think about how do we redeploy this technology stack or this IP or even the knowledge that we have in our brains about this particular problem to a different market need. And that's very different, right? It still comes back to the core. It always comes back to understand your best in the world superpower. What is your core? And come back to that. And then let's start thinking about how do we take that core into a market that is going to allow us to grow and expand the way that we wanted to. So, and you know, in my book, it's like, yeah, do you have conviction? Do you have cash, you know, to get through it? Do you have a core to the business? And then, you know, with that, you've got the ability to kind of organize your team and start experimenting and trying out different things. Or if it doesn't work, you know, then you have to close up. It's, you know, there's not an opportunity out there. Or maybe it's merging with another company. You got to get creative. But not every company can be transformed, right? Some companies don't have a core, right? They just never figured it out. So I would say the companies I work with, great teams a lot of times, and either they have an existing business and that becomes the basis of their business model and their cash generation engine, and that you know that's what helps finance the business into the next phase, or they don't have any business and they're truly pivoting their product and technology into a new space, and that just has a different process that goes with it.
How often would you say the answer is handing it over as a CEO or shutting the company down?
Again, it depends how mature the business is. You know, the more mature it is, the larger it is revenue-wise, then the more likely you can bring in somebody else to run it. If you're not the one to run it and you don't want to do it anymore, then yeah, you could bring somebody else in who could execute in that phase of the business. And I think that's fine. That's legitimate. If it is retrenching to core technology and trying to figure out how to apply that technology to other market opportunities, I would say that kind of has to be the founder. You know, it's hard to bring in a hired CEO to come in when that's the level of pivot that you're talking about. Really, you'd need a small, really creative, multidisciplinary team to go out and run hypotheses against different market opportunities. And you're really, you know, in the book, I tell a story about this company that was, this is back in the dot-com heyday, but they were doing microtransactions back in 2000. And, you know, as befitting of that era, Goldman Sachs was taking them public and, you know, they only had 6 million in revenue. And, you know, it's one of those things. They were doing microtransactions and selling it to media companies. And then the market crashed and they had to fire a bunch of people, but they kept their R&D team and they started experimenting with it. And instead of selling software to media companies, what they did was said, there's a huge opportunity with the mobile carriers. So they rebuilt their whole solution. They took their tech. We say, we know microtransactions better than anybody else. So let's focus on that as our core, our IP around understanding that space, but rebuild the product as middleware that we then take to market and sell to mobile carriers. And they built up a $60 million business that was sold for $330 million a few years later because they just took what we know and our superpower about this very specific technology and shifted our go-to-market entirely.
We talked about raising too much money, following or setting the wrong goals, sometimes pursuing the wrong goals, hiring the wrong people. And this all sounds like we're finding reasons that are not me as a founder making the wrong decisions. But when we look at all the topics, it's, I think more often than not, I as a founder made the wrong decisions. So what is my personal assessment of this, or what does my personal assessment of the situation look like to understand where I am blocking my company's growth, where I am limiting our further journey and trajectory, and figuring out what I need to sometimes also change my beliefs probably, or do better, improve, or also reflect on?
Yeah, so the second chapter in my book is about our mindset and the psychological blind spots that we bring to decision making that cause companies to get stuck. What I found out is that the companies won't transform until the leaders do. And that means confronting your blind spots. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, they find their identity in the business, right? This is how I earn love and belonging and acceptance. And that can be beautiful and it can create a lot of motivation in the early days, but it can also be really harmful because a lot of times that means the decisions we're making are decisions that are meant to make us look good and to want to feel successful and validated by our peers, family, you know, and friends and market. And so that may mean making decisions like raising too much money too early, right? Because if I want to be seen as successful as an entrepreneur, well, I may equate raising money to being successful. And I may say, yeah, I'm going to go raise that $15 million round because then people will look at me positively. So it's an example of a decision that is driven from the wrong place internally, which is a desire for validation, but not in the best interest of the company, because what it's now putting this really high bar on the company of what success looks like, and it's going to stress everybody out, and it's going to be really hard to live up to it. So these are patterns that we all do. I do them all the time, that we all have, right? In my case, I'm a hero, a savior, right? And so I want to save a company, and I want to save employees, you know, and I'll do the work for them and things like that, that are patterns that are deeply held inside of us, start in childhood, that if we don't confront them, they're going to repeat themselves over and over, and they're going to lead to keeping the company stuck or getting it restuck. So what I tell founders, CEOs is, what are the things that you did? What are the patterns that you have? What are the weaknesses, blind spots that led to the decisions that ultimately got the company stuck? And it's a hard process, as you can imagine, but so powerful if they can confront those blind spots, because you want to be in the best athletic position possible to lead the company into its next phase. And so working with coaches, doing training, whatever it is to get past some of those fears and insecurities and doubts and blind spots to emerge as the leader that that company needs, especially if it's, you know, getting a company unstuck, because that's the unsexy part, right? The sexy part is raising a bunch of money and, you know, being early in the process. The unsexy part is, hey, it's not working, and now we need to do something entirely different. So to confront your issues directly and work with people to help you get past them so that you can be in the best position to lead that company moving forward and not fall prey to those insecurities that may have gotten you stuck in the first place, that is one of the most powerful things for any company to do. And it's something that we didn't talk about for a long time, and I think we're getting better about it. You know, we talk about the mental health of CEOs and how much pressure we put on ourselves and, you know, how lonely it can be now, and depression and anxiety and suffering. So I'm glad we have a conversation about it now. But I can tell you again, as the Get Startups Unstuck guy, the sooner you can confront those issues, the better off you'll be and the much higher likelihood you'll have of building something sustainable and successful.
So it's about building a support system for me as a founder to constantly reflect on me and the work and the company?
Yeah, to really understand where your motivations are coming from and what are the healthy and unhealthy patterns that you are living out every day that are causing your suffering and maybe causing the suffering of the team and leading the company to get stuck. And so, yeah, I think having the infrastructure of support, whether it's, you know, coaches, advisors, getting your team's help, your significant other, whatever it is, where you ever get the, you know, support to transform yourself, to be a better leader and show up as the leader that the company needs, it's going to pay off in spades later when the company tries to scale.
It's interesting. It sounds, or it feels, and I personally know it from my, like, I'm not building a venture, but I'm building a company, even with the podcast. And it always feels like this inner work and personal development takes the time from the stuff that's urgent, that you think you should do. And it always feels like, is it the right thing to do right now, thinking about that stuff and the personal and here and there? It, in my opinion, especially in the first times, it, in quotation marks, never feels right.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with it. You know, but I look back at, you know, we talked about Jive before. That was the company I did a while ago. So Jive got started at the same time as Atlassian. We were just, you know, a couple guys in each. They were friends of ours. And, you know, my insecurity at Jive led to wanting to do more playbook things and not following my intuition, and then raising the money at a time that was probably premature. And instead of following my intuition, I followed what the market was telling me to do. And that was a negative pattern I had. And that ultimately, even though Jive went public, it kind of died on the public markets. And I had sowed the seeds of, you know, its ultimate demise early on, where I watched Atlassian kind of follow their intuition and they built out a $40 billion business. Now, we were just as capable of doing that. And if I had followed my intuition and knew better what these negative patterns and insecurities I had that were leading to doing things like raising this money or going after the enterprise and not following what I believe maybe was the right thing for the business, you're talking about a, you know, difference of $40 billion in valuation. And I see that all the time. So I think in the past, it was hard for us to associate some of these softer approaches with downstream outcomes. But I can tell you, it is very real. And leaders and founders who can work from intuition move much faster, attract better people. They inspire those people. They keep them motivated. They bring customers into the fold. And if you are compromised and working from fear, working from insecurity, it can sow the seeds of the company's ultimate destruction without you knowing it. And I see that a lot. And so that's why I wrote a whole chapter about it. And honestly, when I give these talks, that's the content that people pull on. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that we're at a place and time when that conversation is being had. But what I'm saying is, this isn't just soft skills. This isn't just kind of woo, you know, work. You're talking about real outcomes. You're talking about putting yourself, becoming the best conditioned athlete possible to go run this race that you're running. And that is not just a case of having access to better data. It's being the fully embodied, benevolent leader to guide this company where it needs to go and getting out of your own way to do that.
Well, what do you say are the most overlooked areas when we're talking about the inner work and personal development? I think you mentioned figuring out your, let's say, habits and characteristics on how you handle situations. In your case, for example, the trying to be the hero and save others. But I can imagine that there are more dimensions than, in quotation marks, just the characteristics that I have and understanding myself a little better here. So what are other areas that I need to dive deeper into to actually understand what I'm up to?
I mean, how do you figure out what you need to work on? Or once you know what you need to work on, how do you do it?
I think I'm coming from the part of what is often overlooked in the personal work, because I know, for example, when I first time went to a psychologist and talked to her, I always shared the stuff that was on surface level that felt like I'm sharing things, but I then later uncovered that I had so much more that was bothering me that I wasn't talking about because I thought, okay, this superficial and the stuff that I was already reflected on was easy to push forward. And I can imagine that there are other areas that I and other founders and entrepreneurs need to think about more to then figure out, okay, how do I become the best performing and prepared athlete to what I want to be?
Yeah, great question. I would say emotions. That real change in who we are happens at an emotional level, not an intellectual level. And for a lot of CEOs, they spend their whole life living in the mind. But the mind is like a salesperson. It will tell you anything that you want to hear. It will create really complex narratives that you'll believe. But it's not creating change. It's only when you deal at the source code level, and that source code level is deep in your body, and that's the emotional work. So it's much harder work, but it's the real work, and it's much more long lasting and is what allows people to work more from an intuitive space, to not be suffering over decisions, but to really be able to see the decisions for what they are, to inspire people, to guide the market where it needs to go. It's the hardest work, and it takes a long time for a lot of founders and CEOs to get it, because they keep trying to use the mind as the basis for changing. But the mind is what gets us into these problems in the first place, right? And so you're trying to solve a problem by using the thing that caused the problem. So I would say that is the thing that is most useful, was to me as a leader, was once I understood that real change, just like a software product, you got to get into the deep source code, right? And you got to re-engineer this product. And if you're just trying to change the user interface over and over again, and that's your form of trying to be a better leader, it's not going to work. At some level, you have to admit that real change happens at a deeper level. And whatever path you need to go through, whether it's, you know, therapy or, you know, retreats or, you know, working in groups with other CEOs who are not connected to your business, there's a lot of mechanisms out there where people can have access to tools that are going to help them change at a deeper level. And if you're feeling stuck and if you're suffering, it's one of the best things you can do. And it's one of the best things you can do for your people as well, who are working for you or your customers and the business ultimately. Because when you come back to being able to operate from that deeply intuitive space, you move really quickly and you make great decisions. And all decisions are emotional at some level. So the sooner you deal with it, the better off your company's going to be.
So where do I start with this journey when I'm listening to this podcast? And I'm like, okay, it makes sense, but how do I take the first step now that I don't push it away and not do it?
Yeah, great question. It's probably going to come from a place of how much pain does the founder feel around this, because that's going to drive a lot of it. I do think, you know, that 0 to 1 phase, that can be pretty messy, and it's okay, right? Until you figure out product market fit and you really have something on your hands, you're probably not going to be dealing with some of this stuff. But as you get to the 1 to 100 phase, and you really try to grow this business, and you're hiring more team, and you're facing more decisions on an ongoing basis, it's going to come up. And so I think the sooner you deal with it, the better. And that may take the form of getting 360 degree review feedback from people, from hiring a coach, from setting a tone of, you know, being able to have hard conversations with your team and being able to solicit input from them on how things are going, to signing up for and doing, you know, real work on this and making this a part of your pie chart, right? So again, early phase as the company's getting up and running, it may just not have the time to do a lot of this, and it's just all scrambling. But once you start hiring people, and once you have a team, and there's, you know, departments forming, and it becomes a place where you really do have to be in that best athletic conditioning for that role. And a big part of that is not just pretending to be somebody else, but is working from your deepest place of, this is who I really am, and I can use that as the basis to be the best leader for this company at this point in time.
So who is Dave Hirsch really?
I learn more every day. You know, I would say that that's been one of the best parts of writing this book into this phase of life. You know, as a CEO, I think I was often, I mean, there was a big part of me that was in there the whole time, but I was also trying to prove things to people and trying to show up as the identity of a CEO, as opposed to being my full self. And at this point in time, I've done so much work to kind of strip it all down that I can emerge as the more soulful, real version of myself. And the coolest part about that is I'm way more motivated now than I've ever been, right? If you're trying to stay motivated as the identity of me as a CEO, or, you know, a founder, and that's what you're holding on to, or you're trying to use the company as the basis to earn love, you're going to exhaust yourself, right? It's going to be really hard. And so I think companies and that succeed often are led by people who are in their power space. And when you're working from that deeper source and you have done that emotional work, it's like an inexhaustible fuel source, right? As opposed to if you're working from ego and identity, it burns out quickly. If you're working from this deeper, this is who I am, this is why I'm on this planet, this is my purpose, this is my soul, this is who I, you know, it's like an inexhaustible fuel source. You never want to stop going and creating and doing more. And so I got to see that firsthand. And I think as a CEO, I could see all the ways that I messed it up. And that's why it's really rewarding for me now to help other CEOs deal with some of these things and to help their companies be incredibly successful and to try to operate from that place of that inexhaustible fuel source.
Let's say you're in your early 20s building your first company. Do you think it's even possible to do all the work and arrive at the point where you are at the moment? Or does it take some success, some failure, etc., to even being able to arrive there?
No, great question. And I think, yes, you have to have the sandpaper of experience to really keep shaping yourself. Like, that's unavoidable. But I do think the more work you do, the closer to that source you will be working from. And so I know a lot of very enlightened founders in their 20s who are working in a way that reflects who they really are. There's still a lot of growth that needs to happen, and there's still ego, and there's still a lot of other things. That's fine. It's natural. But I see them working from a deeper sense of meaning and from, like, in this country, there's a book that came out called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And it was all about, you know, as you get into midlife, how do you construct a career and a way of being in the world that's more about meaning as opposed to ego and trying to prove yourself. And that's fine. But what I see is even younger founders, they're working towards that second mountain. They're building a base camp on it, as I've said, right? And so they do have a connection to some innate drive inside them. And now you just get to go out and be in the world and find that sandpaper, have that experience, and just keep doing it. And it keeps shaping you into somebody who's capable of building great things in the world.
As the last question of the podcast, what will you say is your advice to founders, knowing that it's hard to determine because every point in life and on the journey, on the trajectory is so different. But from all the stuff that and experience you have and founders you talk to, what will be some last general advice?
Yeah, maybe it's a synthesis of what we've talked about, which is just like a business. You know, when I turn around businesses, it's getting back to the core. Right. And that's how I can help transform a stuck business is say, get back to your core, get back to that thing that you are the best in the world at doing. And the same is true of us as individuals. Right. If we feel out of control, if we feel like things aren't, you know, how do we be that great leader? It's getting back to that core. Just like our business has to have a core. We have that as individuals. And the closer we are to working from that core, that central place of that defines who we really are as a person, the easier all of this becomes and the higher the likelihood that we will do the things we want to do in the world.
Dave, thank you so much for being a part of the Unicorn Bakery. I will link to your book in the show notes, to your LinkedIn in the show notes. I will have to remodel your living room again. So thanks for hosting us here in San Francisco. We had to rearrange a bit here in your living room, and we'll arrange that back so that we don't leave chaos. But it's been such a pleasure. It's been such an honor, and I wish you all the best. And I hope that all the founders listening think that that's a great start to also who think they might be stuck or want to prevent getting stuck with their business, think that it's a good time to also read your book. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.